for some magic to come and make you feel better.
Republican leaders are pushing to build support for President Trump's sweeping tax and spending legislation.
President Trump says he wants the bill passed by Friday. We will bring you the latest.
Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. NPR's producer in Gaza, Anis Baba, reports from inside a new food distribution site that the U.S. and Israel set up in Gaza.
The United Nations calls these sites death traps.
Hunger is a little bit of an addiction. Once you feel that your stomach, your brain, your body is craving something, you will not be afraid of anything.
Also, the view of the U.S. through the eyes of Americans who have left to work abroad.
When I'm out of the United States, I never have to prepare for someone to mistreat me. Some of that is that people automatically know I'm American.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is turning up the pressure on Republicans in the House to get on board with his massive tax cut and spending package. NPR's Tamara Keith reports it's not clear if the president has the votes he needs to pass it.
President Trump has set a July 4th deadline for the bill to be on his desk, but a number of House Republicans are holding out, raising a variety of concerns with the Senate version of the bill that passed yesterday. But Trump has made clear he wants this bill and he wants it passed now. A rotating cast of House Republicans have come over to the White House today to meet with the president. There have been conservative Freedom Caucus members, as well as moderates. In past legislative battles, Trump has been his own best lobbyist. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Now that the U.S. Agency for International Development has been dissolved, the State Department is getting rid of what Secretary Marco Rubio calls a rainbow of unidentifiable logos. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports all USAID will now be branded with an American flag.
In a social media post, the State Department says its redesign is very simple. Gone are the names of all the USAID programs like Power Africa, Feed the Future, or the President's Malaria Initiative. Now there will be an American flag with the words, quote, provided by the United States of America. The Trump administration has canceled 83% of America's foreign aid programs and dissolved an agency that began in 1961. The Lancet Medical Journal says the cuts could lead to 14 million deaths over the next 5 years. The administration disputes that claim. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A bail hearing is expected this hour for Sean Diddy Combs. NPR's Anastasia Seleukis reports the hip-hop mogul was found guilty today of transportation to engage in prostitution, but was acquitted on the more serious charges, racketeering and sex trafficking.
The jury deliberated for more than 13 hours before finding Combs guilty of two counts of a relatively minor federal offense, transporting sex workers across state lines to participate in sex marathons that Combs called freak-offs or hotel nights with two of his former girlfriends. Each of those counts has a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. If he'd been found guilty of the other accusations, Combs would have faced up to life in prison. Some of the people in the courtroom and overflow rooms erupted into gasps and cheers when the first not guilty verdict was announced, and members of both Combs' family and his defense team began to cry. Anastasia Tsioulkas, NPR News, New York.
Trading came to a mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 10 points. This is NPR News. Microsoft is implementing another round of layoffs. The tech giant began sending notices to thousands of employees today. The cuts are expected to affect multiple teams around the world, including its sales division. It's Microsoft's second mass layoff in months and the largest in more than 2 years. Hurricane Flossie has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm. NPR's Ada Peralta reports the hurricane is expected to further weaken over the next few days, but it's also expected to dump heavy rain across Mexico.
Hurricane Flossie is forecast to stay offshore, but the National Hurricane Center is forecasting up to 3 inches of rain to fall in the Mexican states of Michoacán, Colima, and Jalisco. Flash floods and mudslides are possible. This storm comes amid a historically rainy season in Mexico. The capital, Mexico City, for example, has had the rainiest June since 1968. Some highways have looked like rivers in the past few weeks, and many homes and businesses have ended up underwater. Also last month, Hurricane Eric slammed into Puerto Escondido in Mexico's Pacific coast as a Category 3 storm. More than 100,000 people were left without power, and at least two people were killed because of that hurricane. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
A wildfire in northeastern Spain has left at least two people dead. The fire broke out in Catalonia last night. Authorities say farmers were trying to escape the flames in a vehicle. The fire is being fueled by hot, dry conditions. Europe is in the midst of a massive heat wave. Some areas have seen afternoon highs topping 100 degrees. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 80s, southeast winds 5 to 10. For Friday, showers and thunderstorms likely, otherwise sunny, highs 88 to 92.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The House is gearing up to vote on the Senate's version of Trump's sweeping tax and spending bill, but some House Republicans have voiced skepticism about the proposed cuts to Medicaid and the trillions of dollars the bill would add to the deficit. With days to go before the July 4th deadline President Trump imposed, it is not clear whether Republicans have enough votes to pass the Senate version of the bill. Joining us now for more is New York Republican Congressman Mike Lawler. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Congressman, I know that you're among a number of Republicans who headed over to the White House today as Republican leadership continues to push to get this bill through the chamber and to President Trump's desk by end of week. Tell us where you stand on the legislation at this hour on the bill passed by the Senate.
Well, we're still working through it. Obviously, right now it's in the middle of a rules vote, and then ultimately we'll have debate and final passage. I know leadership is continuing to meet with some of the members of the Freedom Caucus. I've had discussions with the White House for a number of days surrounding Medicaid and particular on the Rural Health Fund and how we can use that to support our hospitals throughout my district and across the country. And so we're continuing to, you know, have conversations on that process moving forward once the bill, in fact, is passed.
What was the message that you heard from the White House and from President Trump today?
Well, the president obviously wants to get the bill passed. Number one, this is the largest tax cut. And failure here will result in the largest tax increase in American history. And it would be a disaster for the economy. Obviously, you know, extending the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this doubling of the standard deduction, the enhanced child tax credit, new provisions like no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, an enhanced senior tax credit to offset taxes on Social Security. And of course, something I fought for in this bill, lifting the cap on salt, which we were able to secure, a $40,000 cap, which is 4X the current $10,000, and a massive tax cut for hardworking and middle class families across this country, but especially in New York. So obviously, the tax provisions are critical, border security, increased domestic production of energy, strengthening our military. And really starting to bend the curve on spending. Over the next decade, we're projected to spend $86 trillion as a country, right, as a federal government. And we're talking about $1.6 trillion in savings over the course of the 10 years. That amounts to about 1.8% of overall spending. So you know, as we start to bend the curve with $2 trillion deficits, you know, everybody, Republicans and Democrats need to get serious about tackling our debt. $36 trillion in debt.
Well, let me just jump in here. The Congressional Budget Office found that this spending bill would add roughly $3 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. So, to your mind, are you concerned about growing the nation's debt? It sounds like you are. What should be done?
So, CBO has consistently been wrong in its pronouncements, including 7 years ago when they undercut revenue by $1 trillion on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which we now know has produced the largest revenue that the federal government has ever seen. The question is, how do we start to right-size our spending where we're running $2 trillion deficits? And what you're seeing is, over 10 years, a reduction in spending by $1.6 trillion. You're going to see economic growth, you know, 2, 3, 4%. Over the life of the bill, which is going to be critical, grow our economy and start to move things in the right direction, reducing our deficits and reining in our debt. This is a big challenge, okay, and it's something that's going to require both parties to really focus on in the coming decade.
I want to just jump in here because earlier you mentioned some of the concerns that you've been discussing, including those around health care and Medicaid. And there are estimates, according to CBO, that nearly 12 million people will lose health care coverage, including Medicaid coverage, if this bill becomes law. Congressman Lawler, given that roughly a quarter of the people in your district in New York, some 200,000 people are on Medicaid, that's according to KFF. Are you concerned about what the cuts enshrined in this legislation would mean to the people who live in your district?
Again, let's actually focus what's in the bill and not what is the Democrat talking point. The fact is that you have eligibility verification, making sure that people who are not supposed to be collecting Medicaid benefits are no longer receiving those benefits that they're not entitled to. Second is citizenship verification to make sure that illegal immigrants are not collecting Medicaid benefits. Right now, you have 1.4 million illegal immigrants collecting Medicaid benefits. That is wrong, fundamentally. And third is work requirements. You have nearly 4 million people who are able-bodied adults without dependent children who are refusing to work. They should be trying to get a job, to get employment, to go to school, or to volunteer upwards of 80 hours a month. That's about 20 hours a work week to help get into the workforce, participate in the workforce, and ultimately help themselves because they may be able to get a employer-based health care plan long-term or be able to purchase on the open market. But the objective here is to sustain this program for the long term for those who need it and those who are eligible for it. And you have seen, and this is important, even with these changes, Medicaid spending is going to go up 24% over the next decade, 24%. So when we're talking about how to strengthen the system, this is not about gutting the system. This is about protecting it for those who need it.
Congressman, I've got to jump in here. We've got a minute or so left. I know that you've said you're considering running for governor of New York, and whether you do that or you want run for re-election to your House seat, there are recent polls out there, including, I'll note, one from Fox News that suggests that much of the American public is quite skeptical of this legislation. So what is your message to people in your district who do not support this bill?
Well, again, I think a big part of it is the way that it has been framed by, frankly, obviously the Democrats, where they talk about, you know, cutting Medicaid to provide tax cuts for billionaires. There's no tax cuts for billionaires. This is an extension of existing
law. But there's also polling from Fox News.
But this is an extension of existing law. And the biggest tax cuts in this bill are for the working class and low-income Americans across the country. So when you talk about the bill, you actually have to understand what is actually in the bill, not what has been talked about by the press.
But Congressman, I'll ask again, do you worry about the political consequences if you support this legislation, which for among many people is not popular?
Well, again, when people are actually getting tax cuts, it will be extremely popular among the working class and the middle class and the folks who are going to benefit exceptionally well from the provisions within this bill. The seniors who are going to get an enhanced tax deduction and not have to pay taxes on their Social Security as a result. That is critically important. Right. That is something that's going to benefit Americans all across this country.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I will have to leave it there. Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, thank you.
A social media video promoting President Trump's tax bill is getting a lot of attention in Ukraine. Why? Well, the answer involves a TV star, a mission, and a powerful Ukrainian weapon, humor. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports from Kyiv.
In the social media post produced by the White House, a woman is shown working at a computer late at night. Work more, keep more, no tax on overtime, the subtitles say. The post received hundreds of comments, many from Ukrainians. That's our Motra, they wrote. Motra is a character from a Ukrainian drama series played by a well-known actress Antonina Khizhnyak. Khizhnyak told me her smartphone was pinging non-stop. I was bombarded with hundreds of messages, texts and comments, she said. She said, at first I did not understand what was happening, where this video came from. Someone said it was made by artificial intelligence. It turned out to be an appearance she made in stock footage, which is not copyrighted and can be purchased. But like any good actress, Khizhnyak knew how to make the most of the moment. So she made her own video where she appears as both herself and President Trump.
Hello, this is Antonina Khizhnyak. Yes, this is me. Okay, all right. Yeah, this is Donald Trump from White House. So you have a suit? What?
Her portrayal of Trump involves using an animation of his face on her body and imitating his voice. The two are shown on the phone, making an imaginary deal. He can use her face on one condition.
So, I need your face. I need five Patriots. Deal! Yes, done.
Five Patriots, she says. These are American-made air defense systems. Ukraine desperately needs more Patriots to protect its cities from an escalation in Russian drone and missile attacks. Khizhnyak says you fall asleep and you don't know whether you will wake up, whether you will be lucky in this lottery to survive. On Tuesday, after I spoke with Khizhnyak, the White House announced that it is stopping some weapons shipments, including air defense missiles, that have been already promised to Ukraine. Before this decision, Khizhnyak had joked that maybe one day she would have a chance to speak with Trump in person. Well, I do have a suit, she says. I'm ready to go. Polina Litvinova, NPR News, Kyiv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18. You are listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology, John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date. Learn how you can ensure KAXE's programming is here for the next generation of Northern Minnesotans by asking your financial advisor about charitable IRA distributions. For additional giving options, visit KAXE.org. Click on Give. Thank you so much for your support. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, July 2nd, in the year 2010, I spot my first early goldenrods in bloom. The early goldenrod is an easy plant to identify because it's early, and it is the first goldenrod to bloom in northern Minnesota. And why is that important? Well, it's important because there are between 10 and probably 15 different species of goldenrods that grow in Minnesota, and oftentimes determining one from another can be the task best given over to a professional botanist. Sometimes it is rather difficult to tell one species of goldenrod from another. We all recognize the goldenrods. They all have those little bright yellow flowers that grow in those clusters at the ends of the branches. But to actually pick out which one is smooth goldenrod and which one is early goldenrod and which one is blended goldenrod and which one is zigzag goldenrod, and on and on and on, can be very difficult. That's why I always look forward to the blooming of the early goldenrod, because I am assured of the identification of that one. It is simply the first goldenrod to bloom in northern Minnesota.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. What does it take to get food today in Gaza? It involves a perilous journey that NPR's producer in Gaza, Anis Baba, experienced himself last week. Hundreds of people have been killed by Israeli troops as they approached these food sites, according to health officials and international medical teams in Gaza. U.S. officials have accused American media of spreading Hamas misinformation. The account that you are about to hear is rare reporting by a journalist from inside a new food distribution site that the U.S. and Israel set up in Gaza, sites which the United Nations calls death traps. Before we start, a warning. In this story, you will hear the sounds of gunfire and descriptions of violence. Here's NPR's Daniel Estrin.
Strict Israeli controls on food entering Gaza have driven widespread hunger. Our colleague, Anas Baba, has lost a third of his body weight during the war. He's been eating one small meal a day, rationing his food supplies until they ran out 3 weeks ago.
I cannot find the basics, just like flour, cooking oil, lentils.
Israel bans international journalists from independent access to Gaza. Baba is from Gaza and has been reporting for NPR throughout 20 months of war, reporting on the war and living through it, experiencing hunger and observing what it does to a person's body.
Women faint in the street, children faint in the street. Hunger is a little bit of an addiction. Once you feel that your stomach, your brain, your body is craving something, you will not be afraid of anything, and you can do anything to bring food for your children and for yourself.
Last Monday evening, he and his cousin walked for hours to get food at a new distribution site run by private American contractors with a group called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF.
It's truly a day in my life that I will never, ever forget. We packed a small backpack, water, bandages, first aid kit.
Others tuck a large empty sack under their belt on one hip and on the other.
And the other side is a knife to protect themselves from the looters and the bandits.
Around midnight, Baba joined large crowds waiting to approach the food site. GHF has changing hours and opens and closes the site at very short notice, they say to prevent crowd surges. But to get there, you have to pass through an Israeli military zone. Baba says some edge close to get to the front of the crowd before the site opens, despite the risk of Israeli soldiers perceiving them as a threat.
This is the moment where everyone here says that the GHF site is open, and now it's 1:30 after midnight.
So all of the cars turns on the engine and they started to race each other, motorcycles. And between them, there is people running between the cars. I saw some people that are being crashed. I saw some people that they were literally underneath the cars.
He ran with the crowd, but when they got close to the site, they were shocked to find an Israeli tank. The crowd was wrong. The food site was not yet open.
Every single person started to retreat and run, and the tank did not even wait a second.
Baba recorded the gunfire from a distance. He and his cousin threw themselves to the ground.
And I heard the gunshots and the people screaming that they are injured, and other they're saying that my brother died, my friend died.
It's still, at the meantime, 1:48, and the gunfire didn't stop. And I can see in front of me that people are still waiting. They're not leaving.
The Israeli military told NPR people gathered near the site and adjacent to Israeli IDF troops. Quote, reports of injured individuals as a result of IDF fire in the area were received. The details are under review.
At 2 a.m., the gunfire just stopped, and we told ourselves maybe this is a sign from them. We were going to go for another run. I stepped on bodies, and they didn't stop. This is another run.
This time, the GHF site was open. Baba watched large crowds tear down a fence to reach boxes of food sitting on wooden pallets.
I grabbed my cell phone and started to record what I'm seeing in front of me.
And people enter, fighting each other to take as much as possible.
A woman in her 40s with her son, and that woman, sweaty, with an angry face. She was holding two knives in her own hands, and she was screaming at everyone, do not even touch my son or the food.
It didn't used to be this kind of free-for-all. For most of the war, there were hundreds of aid distribution centers across Gaza. UN agencies would send a text message when it was your turn to pick up food, and everyone got some. Israel and the U.S. accused Hamas of diverting that aid, so they set up the GHF to keep Hamas away. But at the GHF site, Baba saw people he believes were Hamas members based on their looks, taking food for their families. GHF told NPR, it's impossible to screen for individuals affiliated with Hamas, but said it was preventing Hamas from controlling the flow of aid. GHF also said it forbids Palestinians from filming U.S. contractors at the site.
People came to me telling me, look at your forehead. There is three green laser points on my head from the American contractors. And one of them said out loud with the speaker, no filming is allowed.
Asked about this reporting, GHF acknowledged the concern that the changing hours could expose people to potential Israeli military fire. The military says it's opened new roads and created new signage. GHF says Hamas has wounded and killed people en route to their sites and has killed and threatened Palestinians working with them. 170 rights groups and aid groups have called for the GHF system to be dismantled. At the distribution site, Baba grabbed whatever food he could find tossed on the ground.
I pulled 5 kilograms of rice. It was open with some sand on it, but I didn't care. It's food, I can wash it.
His cousin got trampled on the ground by the crowds, and he helped pull him up. Then they fought upstream through a river of people trying to leave with their bags of food. Walking back, they were stopped by 4 masked thieves.
They were having big knives, and they told us, you do have 2 options. Give us half of what you had, okay? Or we're gonna harm you.
When the thieves refused to negotiate, Baba and his cousin threw 2 bags of food at the thieves and ran away with enough food to give their relatives. Baba was left with about 1.5 weeks of supplies for himself. Later that morning, Baba went to the hospital. Health officials said more than 200 people were wounded and 26 killed outside the food site.
There is no white shrouds in the hospitals in the meantime. The dead bodies that lying on the ground were covered by the same sacks that they were taken at to fill it up with food.
Every day, GHF has opened its food distribution sites, including today. Gaza health officials say hungry people seeking food have been killed, and many people return from the sites empty-handed. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv, with NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, National Native News. Coming up before 5 o'clock, we'll have North Star Stories produced by Ampers. And at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We also thank L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Partly cloudy overnight, lows near 60, and mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs in the mid to upper 80s, southeast winds 5 to 10. For Friday, showers and thunderstorms scattered throughout the day, otherwise sunny. Highs 88 to 92.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. With Alaska U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's help, Senate Republicans passed a sprawling budget reconciliation bill that contains much of President Trump's domestic policy agenda. Alaska tribes and Native organizations have raised concerns about the bill. The Tlingit and Haida Indian tribes recently sent a letter to Alaska's congressional delegation opposing the bill with concerns about clean energy, food security, health care, and lands and forests. In a statement Monday, the Fairbanks Native Association said it's deeply troubled by the passage of the spending bill, raising concerns about funding cuts to tribes, which provide critical services, including health care and food assistance. Murkowski said it was one of the hardest votes she's ever taken, and she's hoping it will be changed further before Congress sends it to the president's desk. She said she helped improve the bill for Alaska, but she said in an emailed statement, quote, "It is not good enough for the rest of our nation, and we all know it," end quote. The bill's passage followed intense negotiations between Murkowski and Senate leaders, aimed at retooling the bill to overcome her objections to removing benefits from Alaskans on Medicaid and food assistance. Murkowski said she decided to vote yes because Republicans made adequate changes to rural health care and food assistance. She cited a $50 billion fund for rural hospitals and clinics and added flexibility for Alaska in administering changes to SNAP. Only three Senate Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the bill. Alaska U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan voted yes. The bill includes new oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Murkowski has championed those for years. The bill goes to the House, where a different version passed in May without a vote to spare. Any changes would have to be approved again in the Senate. The Miccosukee tribe in Florida is opposing the Trump administration's new immigration facility at an airstrip in the Everglades, which the administration calls Alligator Alcatraz. Chairman Talbert Cypress told ABC News that the tribe held a meeting this week regarding the facility, which is located on tribal traditional homelands of Miccosukee and Seminole people.
The tribe has been at home in the Big Cypress for centuries. And what was decided at the meeting was to examine all avenues that we have to temporarily delay this facility.
Cypress says the tribe's concerned about any potential environmental impacts and safety concerns for tribal members. Demonstrators have reportedly been in the area opposing the facility, as President Trump was given a guided tour on Tuesday. The administration is touting the area for its remote location and surrounding wildlife as barriers for people to escape. Native Americans in Washington state face opioid and fentanyl overdose rates four times the national average. Isabel Charlet has more.
Leaders are calling for more investment in treatment centers and transitional housing to address the problem. While nationally, fentanyl overdoses have declined, Native American fatalities have surged since the pandemic. Representative Deborah LeCanoff is part of the State Tribal Opioid Fentanyl Task Force. During the task force's third annual summit, tribal leaders and state agencies met for 3 days and heard from community members in recovery from opioid use disorder. Last year, says LeCanoff, the task force partnered with tribal governments and invested in substance abuse treatment facilities based on a successful model created by the Swinomish.
The model that Swinomish created 12 years ago has now been incorporated into over 20 tribally owned substance abuse disorder facilities that are healing all Washingtonians.
LeCanoff says in the next couple of years, the task force will focus on transitional housing for those recovering from substance abuse. She says this is a nonpartisan issue and it will take everyone working together to make change. I'm Isabel Charlet.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Next.
International Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill passed the Senate. It's now being considered in the House. It would cut trillions of dollars in taxes, mostly for the well-off. To help offset that, it would also make the biggest cuts to the social safety net in decades, to things like food aid. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is here to walk us through the latest. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Jennifer, NPR has reported a lot on changes to Medicaid, which provides health care for some 70 million low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. And scaling it back has been controversial, even among congressional Republicans. Can you just briefly explain to us what's included in the Senate bill?
Right. And with the reminder, as you said, lawmakers in both chambers still have to agree on one version. But the Senate version would cut Medicaid spending even more than the House had by about $1 trillion. Now, it's mainly through a new requirement that people would have to work at least 80 hours a month unless they're exempt. And overall, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says this package could cause nearly 12 million people to lose health insurance over the next decade.
Which is, of course, a lot of people. I want to turn to some of the safety net cuts that haven't gotten as much attention, like food benefits. Tell us what could happen there.
Yes, yes. So more than 40 million people get food stamps, as they're known, or SNAP. It's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It would lose 20% of its funding, and that's the largest cut in its history. Now, this is also partly from a change to its existing work requirement. The Senate bill bumps up the age people have to work by a decade until age 65, and parents who used to be exempt would now have to work if their kids were 14 or older. Now, as with Medicaid, one concern is that people would run into red tape trying to prove they're working. The CBO estimates this change could push more than 2 million people off food aid. Now, a couple more things on food aid. The spending package makes it harder for states to waive these work requirements, and conservatives have long argued that it's just too easy. You've got entire states where they're waived. The Senate bill says you could only get a waiver if you live in a place with an unemployment rate above 10%, so quite high. And finally, for the first time, the federal government would not pay for all food aid. Most states would have to chip in.
Which sounds to me like a really big change for states. So how would that work?
Yeah, it's tied to how much states have over or underpaid for SNAP. Researchers say these error rates are mostly unintentional, but it would mean that most states would now have to pick up between 5% and 15% of food aid costs. Katie Berg at the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says this undermines the whole guarantee that people in need should get food aid no matter where they live. And she says if states faced a budget crunch, they might shrink their SNAP program or even opt out altogether.
So this is really a proposal that fundamentally changes the structure of SNAP, jeopardizes food assistance for millions of low-income families, and could end SNAP as a nationwide program.
Jennifer, I want to ask you about something that got quite a bit of attention for reducing poverty temporarily during the coronavirus pandemic, which is the federal child tax credit. Any big changes there?
Yes, though not as big as some were calling for during the 2024 election, including now Vice President J.D. Vance. The Senate bill does boost the tax credit from $2,000 per child to $2,200, and that would rise with inflation. But unlike during the pandemic, lawmakers did not expand this to include the lowest income families. And currently, they don't qualify for that full credit because they just don't earn enough. Now, Sophie Collier is with the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. And she says for her, this really reflects the overall tilt of this tax and spending package in favor of the wealthy.
Even this small provision that is kind of meant to help families is not reaching the children and families where it could do the most good, where that $200 actually could be more meaningful.
Jennifer, I'll let you have the last word here. Anything else we should note?
Yes, another key change to the child tax credit. At least one parent now would need a Social Security number. And Collier says by one estimate that could disqualify 2.6 million children who are U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents. And I should just add, there are provisions in the package that would also cut federal health care and food benefits for some immigrants with legal status.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden, thank you.
Thank you.
In Wisconsin today, the state Supreme Court struck down a ban on almost all abortions that was more than a century old. The Democratic Attorney General in Wisconsin, Josh Call, had brought the case. Here he is reacting to the ruling.
Today's ruling marks a major victory for reproductive freedom following the uncertainty and harm to women's health that have resulted from the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Sarah Lear of Wisconsin Public Radio joins us now from Madison to talk through all of this. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Okay, so tell us more about what the court decided today.
The court ruled that a law passed before the Civil War is no longer in effect. That law banned all abortions except those done to save a pregnant woman's life. You mentioned Attorney General Call earlier. He brought this lawsuit just days after the Dobbs ruling because Wisconsin was in a legal gray area and he was concerned about abortion providers being prosecuted under this long dormant abortion ban. Mm-hmm. Today, the court's liberal majority said laws passed more recently basically overwrote the 19th century ban. So that means abortion is legal here in Wisconsin until 20 weeks of pregnancy.
Okay, so what sort of reactions are you hearing, like from people in the state who are against abortion rights?
Yeah, Republicans and anti-abortion advocates have accused liberal justices of judicial activism. The majority leader in Wisconsin Senate, a Republican named Devin Lemahieu, was one of the critics.
It appears that once again the state Supreme Court liberals sort of went rogue and overturned legislative power.
The court has had a liberal majority since mid-2023, so this outcome was expected by many. Just for some background, the last two elections for the state Supreme Court here have been the most expensive judicial races ever in U.S. history. And abortion rights were a big talking point in both of those elections.
Yeah. Can you talk more about what abortion access is like in Wisconsin right now? Like, does this ruling substantively change anything?
Well, advocates for abortion rights are celebrating this ruling because it does provide clarity. But in a sense, it also just preserves the status quo. When Dobbs came down 3 years ago, providers here stopped offering elective abortions. But in the fall of 2023, clinics once again were offering abortions here because of a lower court decision in the attorney general's favor. Today's decision affirms that lower court decision. It's also worth noting that there's other restrictions on abortion still in effect in Wisconsin. There's a mandatory ultrasound law and a 24-hour waiting period.
That is Wisconsin Public Radio's Sarah Lear. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:44. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, North Star Stories produced by Ampers News from communities throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Blast Wi-Fi. Featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly, Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. We also thank the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com. Member FDIC. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 80s, winds from the southeast 5 to 10. For Friday, scattered showers and thunderstorms likely, otherwise sunny and warm, highs 88 to 92. Up next, North Star Stories. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, tariffs take a toll on the state's economy. Then, why federal changes may mean more nuclear energy plants in Minnesota. And the shores of Lake Superior face urgent coastal threats. I'm Chantel Sings. Minnesota exports are down. The Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED, reported that state exports dipped 6% during the first quarter of 2025 compared to the previous year. DEED blamed the losses on what it called on-again, off-again tariffs imposed by the Trump administration. The agency said numbers were down in 8 of the state's top 10 exports. The largest drop was in the cereal category, including corn and wheat, which was down 63%. DEED noted that while U.S. exports are modestly up, Minnesota was one of 20 states that recorded a decline or no growth. Next, a recent executive order is giving some Minnesota lawmakers renewed hope that the state could cash in on nuclear energy, but that has others concerned. Jose Osoria has more.
President Trump recently signed executive orders to accelerate the development of nuclear energy in the United States. The orders would quadruple the country's nuclear capacity by 2050. Minnesota Representative Spencer Igoe is excited by what this could mean for the state of Minnesota.
And if we plan this all out right, we could see a total resurgence of Minnesota being an energy exporter with very affordable and reliable power within a decade.
Representative Igoe believes that nuclear power is a viable solution that will future-proof the country and address the state's energy needs.
And we live in a time where energy demand is increasing exponentially.
But not everyone agrees with Representative Igoe's energy solution.
Our position here is that the potential risk of catastrophic radiation releases from accidents with these machines are too big a risk to take.
John LaForge is the co-director of NukeWatch, a nuclear watchdog organization.
There are safer, far cheaper alternatives available, along with simple energy conservation and efficiency, such that we could replace the 18 or 19% of the electricity that's produced by nuclear reactors in the United States.
Representative Igoe thinks that educating the public will help spread awareness about the positive aspects of nuclear power.
Nuclear doesn't look like what it did now. And then, you know, people also think of Fukushima. You know, we're also not right on the Pacific Ocean. And I think when you talk about where nuclear is too, like how much safer these new facilities are that are being built, also mentioning that the waste they produce is actually being researched and turned into another type of fuel itself.
Mr. LaForge points out that there are already signs of the negative environmental impact reactors have had in Minnesota, specifically the two nuclear reactors located on the Mississippi River, in Monticello and on Prairie Island.
You know, these operating reactors are allowed by law to emit radioactive gases and liquids into the air and water on a daily basis, some of which reached the Mississippi River, was highly contaminated with radioactive tritium, the radioactive form of hydrogen, which cannot be separated from water once it's contaminated the body of water.
The moratorium on expanded nuclear power consumption is still in effect in Minnesota, but there's a strong movement among some within the state legislature to rethink this position. Representative Spencer Igoe describes what he hopes will happen.
If we could return to the legislature next year with a global agreement that we have found the way to lift the moratorium, that every community in Minnesota is happy. We would lift the moratorium, and then at that point, we would probably direct the Minnesota Department of Commerce to start reaching out to the U.S. Department of Energy about trying to secure nuclear investment grants.
For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osorio.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota Point, a Duluth neighborhood and natural sandbar, is facing growing risks from erosion and flooding. Earlier this summer, residents gathered at Turning Point Summit, an event to share a new coastal resilience plan and manage the coastal risks. The plan addresses repeated storm damage, shoreline loss, and rising lake levels. It includes steps to restore and protect the environment while improving public access. The aim is to reduce future damage and support long-term resilience for the area. Partners from the city, state, and local community are working together to carry out the plan.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Some things become clearer with some distance, like home. The farther you travel from your native country, the clearer you may be able to see it. And over the years, more Americans have left the U.S. to roam the world as digital workers. NPR's Frank Langfitt recently spoke with some of them, and they said they only gained insights into certain aspects of American culture and identity after they left the U.S.
Michael Jensen has spent the last 8 years traveling and living with his husband in 30 different countries. Jensen credits his wanderlust to America's pioneering spirit and the encouragement to explore the world.
I've had the freedom as an American to reinvent myself over and over. There was no societal norm holding me in place.
Drive and hard work fuel the American dream. Jensen says many Americans want to stand out, but he found that some people in some other countries don't. He came across the following concept in Australia.
There's something called the tall poppy syndrome. The idea of that is you do not want to be taller than everybody else, and if you do, they're going to cut you down. Americans, if you talked about the tall poppy syndrome, they'd be like, what the hell? I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course you want to be the tallest poppy you can possibly be, and that's celebrated.
Jensen thinks many characteristics of American life cut both ways. The United States' $30 trillion economy creates tremendous consumer choice. Jensen compares a grocery store in England, where he was living when we spoke, with a Fred Meyer's superstore in Seattle.
Here, you go to the grocery store, and, you know, there's a healthy selection of chips. But when I look at the chip aisle in a Fred Meyer, it's 30, 40 feet long of every different combination of chip. You know, on one hand, sure, it's great. You can have every kind of chip you want. On the other hand, it feels absurd and overwhelming.
Michael Kohler's a screenwriter who's lived in more than 16 countries over the past 9 years. One thing his travels have taught him is that Americans are, comparatively, very chatty.
People from different countries have definitely pointed out that apparently I talk a lot, which is hilarious because I think by American standards, I'm fairly introverted.
Kohler recalled watching a sunset from a balcony in Poland with the woman he was interested in.
And I was like, man, just look at that sunset. Oh, you see those birds? And she was, Michael, yes, I see the sunset. I see the birds. Can we just not mention the sunset and the birds? Because I have my pair of eyes as well.
In co-working spaces, Kohler noticed Americans were often the last to leave, reinforcing a reputation for industry rooted in the Protestant work ethic, a reputation that some in Europe also make fun of. Kohler cites a meme about out-of-office messages a couple of years ago.
The European out-of-the-office, I'll be on vacation for the next 5 weeks. If you email me, I'll get back to you after that. The American out-of-office, hey, so I'm going in for kidney surgery. I probably am going to have to duck out around like 4 p.m., but I'll be back up and running at like 5:30.
My name is Stephanie Perry, and I see the world as a house sitter.
Perry began roaming the world full-time in 2018. She supports her travel by looking after other people's homes. Perry also happens to be Black. She says she found that when she's overseas, people see her as American first and that she's less likely to encounter racism.
When I'm out of the United States, I never have to prepare for someone to mistreat me. Some of that is that people automatically know I'm American.
And right? It's because of how you dress, the way you hold yourself?
Definitely the Old Navy clothes. It's probably the way I smile. I'm smiling at people and saying good morning to people, right? Very American. And that comes with privileges. And there are a lot of places where the American privilege will far outweigh whatever anti-blackness they might experience.
Perry is easy to peg as an American. She has a relaxed confidence and warm personality. Perry recalls sitting on a barrier at a mall in Malaysia, waiting to watch a water show.
The security guard came by and made everyone move off of a barrier, and he let me just sit there, right? He was just like, she don't know. Let the American do what she wants to do.
Perry runs a business that helps fellow black women plan lives abroad. She feels more comfortable overseas and says she has no plans to return to the U.S. to live anytime soon. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
James Moss, a psychologist and sleep researcher, died last week at the age of 86.
He spent decades teaching at Cornell University, studying the link between sleep and human health.
You have to value sleep because sleep is the best predictor of general health and longevity, as well as being essential for learning, for problem solving.
That's Moss speaking with NPR back in 2003.
If you want to be a good athlete, if you want to be a good golfer, if you want to be a good pianist and you need hand-eye coordination, hand-foot coordination, all those connections are formed very late in the night in stage 2 sleep and in REM sleep.
So that's my problem. Moss often spoke about how Americans do not get enough sleep, and his research linked sleep deprivation to a range of health issues like type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and stress.
He told NPR that even a little drowsiness can be dangerous.
They don't notice it when they're at work if the adrenaline is rushing, but the minute they go back to the office to sit down or they, God forbid, get behind the wheel of a car, you can have a sleep seizure in a second, going from having your eyes wide open to your thinking brain totally turned off within 80 feet of driving. And that's why we have a tremendous number of car accidents due to drowsy driving.
Moss co-wrote the 1998 bestseller Power Sleep, the revolutionary program that prepares your mind for peak performance.
It helped popularize the term power nap, and Moss jokingly said it helped people sleep better.
And as my students know here, the world's greatest cure for insomnia these days is to read Power Sleep. Any two pages you've told me will put you right out.
That's a clip from a lecture that Moss gave at Cornell University, where he taught for almost 50 years.
He lectured to more than 65,000 students while there, touting the benefits of good health.
If you learn nothing else, I want you to know, obviously, that sleep is a necessity. It's not a luxury. It is the quantity and quality of your sleep that in large measure is going to determine your success in your waking life.
That was Professor James Moss. He died last week at the age of 86. All right, we are well into the summer and all of the season's beloved traditions, like barbecues, pool days.
Or being trapped at a party by someone pulling out their guitar and playing Wonderwall.
The song that will not die. Well, the rock band Green Day and tens of thousands of their fans also got to experience that on Monday. At a sold-out show in Luxembourg, frontman Billy Joe Armstrong invited an audience member on stage to play guitar during one of the band's biggest hits, Good Riddance.
But the fans seem to be playing something else. And once Armstrong realized what was happening, he intervened.
Nice try. But the original singer of Wonderwall, Liam Gallagher of Oasis, he appreciated the tribute, later tweeting, "Best song of the night."
And this is the part where you sing along if you know it.
I don't want to. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More. For discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila, learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Lots of local information and stories for you there. You can also become a member. Click on that donate button. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 tonight, Annie Lou and Nelson, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 60, and mostly sunny.